Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the Editorial Committee to the annual lecture in honour of the founding editor of the Modern Law Review, Lord Chorley of Kendal. We're delighted that after more than one pressing invitation, we've persuaded our colleague Bill Cornish to give the 23rd lecture in the series. Bill needs no elaborate introduction from me. He's a legal historian and intellectual property lawyer of immense distinction. He taught at this school for many years. I well remember his first purposeful entry into the library in the fall of 1962. But in authentic Australian manner, he's gone walkabout from the school on a number of occasions to places like Queen Mary College, the Max Planck Institute, and of course he's presently at Cambridge. But he remains on the editorial committee of the review, and we claim him among our number. We on the committee are particularly pleased that Bill's giving the lecture this afternoon for one other reason. He represents a real link with our genealogy, with Theo Chorley. They shared a room together at the school in the 1970s, and they were close friends. It would have given Chorley immense pleasure to know that Cornish spoke today on the subject of authors in law, and I'm going to encourage him to do that now.
Thank you very much indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, in order to render you receptive to a lecture on the place of author, the author in copyright law, I asked the Shaw librarian to fill the welcoming air with music, since music is today an art form so central to the copyright enterprise. And in case you were engaging in conversation, you've been listening to Beethoven's Mighty Quartet in B-flat, Opus 130. And I chose that in order to introduce my personal word of recollection of Theo Chorley. As Simon says, I was one of a small band who worked under his editorial guidance on the Modern Law Review, and of all of us who did so revere his memory as a man of ever-present humanity and considerable range of interests. His family arranged for him a memorial meeting at which things were spoken and played which reflected much of what he himself cherished most. Amongst them, the Delmi Quartet played the profound slow movement from Opus 130, and the occasion lingers in my memory as a fine tribute to a splendid man. It also provides two links to this evening's theme. The first is Beethoven, who was not just a composer of exemplary vision. He was also, for legal purposes, an author, at least in those legal systems which had instituted some notion of copyright in works. His genius had recognition beyond national boundaries, but such copyright law as there had been, as there was at that stage, had withdrawn from any simple equation between intellectual creation and the production of results without limit of time or of geography. And since, to our detriment, Beethoven didn't follow his master Haydn's footsteps so far as even to visit this country, Opus 130 probably enjoyed copyright here only if his English publisher had arranged for a first publication in this country. The publisher Clementi did register two of the last six quartets, and just possibly one of them was Opus 130. This shows how, in most countries, France was for some time an exception, copyright was acquiring a jealous territorial bias. Through the 19th century, this would lead via bilateral agreements to the multilateral arrangement for mutual protection laid down in the Berne Convention for the Protection of Literary and Artistic Works, originally of 1886. And this trade-off between states suggests that property rights in artistic productions lie some way below the hallowed ground of human rights universally acknowledged. The second link to my theme is this. By some rare fusion, the memorial meeting for Theo Chorley took place in a fine room belonging to the Stationers' Company, just by the Old Bailey. And the Stationers, guild forerunners of the modern publisher, had been the real instigators of the copyright idea, not just for this country, but for the world. It's a first question of the checkered history of copyright. Why did the Stationers, the capitalists of book and other print production, accept that a right of protection against piratical copying by trade rivals should be rooted in the act of authorship? Why not start with their own act of publication? It's a question which recurs today. Authors' rights are dead, proclaims Neil Turkovitz, counsel to the American Recording Industry Association, but succeeds in demonstrating only how much he wishes they were. Copyright already inhabits some worlds of complex organization. Productions of, for instance, audiovisual material involving the drawing together of treatment writing, script writing, filming, soundtrack music, acting, other performing, as well as overall directing. The activity is as thoroughly collective as writing a novel, painting a portrait, composing a string quartet remains instinctively individual. Those who organize complex audio or audiovisual productions resist the claims of creative or interpretive contributors to be treated with the scrupulous concern appropriate to the sole genius. They do so now as never before, because, of course, the media, computer, and telecommunications industries are together opening the Pandora's box of digitization. From it will fly forth every variety of multimedia product, some of them virtually real. Many will derive their content from a host of inputs, including existing copyright works. Great corporations, smart card businesses, cottage whiz kids are all going to want simple access to the pool of existing material and dread the prospect of copyright laws which allow self-important, super-sensitive, or, let's face it, silver-seeking souls to flaunt their exclusive rights in ways that may put pay to new and exciting possibilities. Why, then, authors' rights? Let's return for a moment to our own precocious history in copyright matters. The essential truth is that London congeries, the Stationers' Company, they were denounced in the 18th century as a conger, needed the respectability which connection to authorship conferred. The Stationers, trade partners of the state and its church, had operated the Tudor and Stuart licensing system for printing in ways which gave members, and in some cases the whole company, unlimited monopolies in titles or even in classes of work. State licensing sickened after the Restoration and died after the Glorious Revolution, though the Stationers continued to recognize perpetual rights between one another. But threatened for the first time by provincial copiers, they needed afresh some general power of prohibition. They got it in the Statute of Anne, 1710, for each work published and registered for a limited term 14 years, sometimes extendable for another 14. But given the mistrust out against them, they accepted something which they'd been inclined previously to skate over. This was that initial title to protection must lie with the author for his act of intellectual creation, and if a stationer wanted it for himself, he must take it by assignment of the copy. One of the silliest of current theories is that the Act of Anne was an act for stationers, which the judges later, in the celebrated Battle of the Books, transmogrified into an author's right. Certainly, the judges would unearth, from what one might call their subconsciences, a common law right of authors even in their unpublished work. But ultimately, in 1774, the House of Lords would settle that this common law right in effect operated only for the period before publication. After that, the statute, with its limited periods, took over. Led by Lord Camden, the Lords adopted liberal authorities from the Scots courts. They rejected Lord Mansfield's preference for the perpetual copy, which was being sought by his former clients from the Congers. The truth is that from 1710 onwards, the first need to outlaw piracy was an interest shared by author and publisher, and so in large measure it has remained in any country where copyright laws have been conceded. The battle of the books then determined that, whatever else, copyright could not be unending. However high the moral claim of the author, it was thereafter accepted that eventually exclusive rights must be overridden by a public interest in unimpeded and competitive access to a work. Even a copyright which derived from the act of intellectual creativity could not escape utilitarian calculation. The policy behind the law was conceived by many to consist of a stimulant to the production of new work, material as well as spiritual, in order to enrich and diversify the whole culture. Britain had struck a balance which limited copyright to a quite short period after publication of a work, before the United States were in a position to formulate their own copyright law, or the revolutionaries of France their first droit d'auteur. When they did so, the arguments were variously couched in both idealist and utilitarian terms, and similar limitations were adopted. If publishers and other producers of the work of authors were to argue for wider and longer rights, rights which endured for decades more than invention patents and industrial design rights, they had to cling to their authors' coattails. For if the law gave exclusive rights of publication, or indeed performance, in order to induce production, as was an obvious and compelling motivation for the patent system, extensive periods of protection were scarcely justifiable. 60 years ago, Sir Arnold Plant, Castle Professor of Commerce in this school, put it beyond contradiction, quoting amongst others David Hume to his publisher, "I have heard you frequently say that no bookseller would find profit in making an edition which would take more than 3 years in selling." Among other things, this must mean that the price which a publisher or other exploiter will pay an author outright will scarcely differ, however long or short the term of legal protection against imitation. Indeed, the long periods of modern copyright can only begin to be justified if authors of enduring works do draw continuing shares by way of royalty from the profits that they make. In most countries, legislators have come to be sufficiently convinced of this to adopt the minimum standard which has been prescribed in the Berne Convention since 1908. The copyright given to authors must last at least for their lifetime and 50 years thereafter. Equally, they've been prepared to move with changing technology so as to extend copyright to uses of material in sound recordings, films, broadcasts, cablecasts, and now, controversially, computer programs. Underlining such thinking is the modern growth in most developed systems of copyright, though here the United States is a troublesome exception, of a fringe of additional and separate rights called, in scrupulous countries, related or neighboring rights to authors' rights, and then confused into an almost indecipherable jumble by the draftsmen of our own 1988 Act. Their distinct nature, these neighbouring rights, however, remains clear, for instance, in recent EC directives. One of these indeed requires, in copyright laws throughout the community, neighbouring rights for performers, film and audiovisual producers, as distinct from film directors, who are belatedly to become authors, even in this country, sound recording producers, broadcasting organisations. We in Britain already have these neighbouring rights, as we do also for independent cable casters and for publishers in the format of their editions. Neighbouring rights are distinct from the copyright system, from the copyright given to authors in the following ways. Save in the transitional case of performers, they're given directly to those who invest in or otherwise finance production. And their terms, though lengthening in some cases to 50 years from exploitation or occasionally from production, are not measured in a way which secures any inheritable property right. They're broadly equivalent to other industrial property, and rightly so. The author as bearer of longevious copyright is a problematic being. As I've already said, he, not to forget she, may seem no more than decently draped window dressing for entrepreneurial interests, particularly where the author has sold the copyright outright, and also in more curious ways, when the rights are administered collectively so that the most successful authors absorb the main costs of the collecting society. There have always been those who, for whatever psychological imperative, judge even the finest creative talents to be overvalued. As this argument goes, what is undervalued by romantic adulation is the social contribution that allows talent to flourish and be labelled genius, the very state of the art, education in its methods and practices, promotional hyping, and so on. Michel Foucault, no less, has led a postmodern charge against the cult of the romantic author, and a bevy of deconstructing furies have elaborated his Delphic prognostications of a new creative future in which the collective will replace the individual. Foucault's own concept of authorship, I'm not going to go into it, differs in striking ways from that of lawyers. Insofar as his ideas are relevant to present copyright policy, they impinge upon two characteristics of the author in law, which have often enough disturbed others before him. First, copyright is not confined to great or even to substantial works of art. If it were, some people, probably judges, would have to determine what qualifies as sufficient art, and subjective judgment would range anarchically around. Just occasionally, at the fringes of the present law, this sort of judgment is required. Once upon a time, for instance, the House of Lords felt impelled to rule that a certain suite of furniture did not amount to a work of artistic craftsmanship within the Copyright Act. Though it took pages of convoluted agony to say so, in essence, the objects were judged to be of such tasteless design as to be unsuited for the reception of their lordship's stately fundaments. In all legal systems, for most categories of work, copyright is conceded without any judgment of aesthetic quality beyond a low threshold of creativity associated with the concept of originality. Attitudes differ somewhat in defining this threshold, though there is some consensus that works of low originality will only be accorded thin copyright against close imitation of virtually the whole work. This country, along with its disciples, is prepared to go particularly far down the track of protecting mere sweat of the literary brow, such as goes into the labour of writing trade catalogues or television schedules. Even the United States has been forced back a little way from this, by the Supreme Court's recent decision refusing copyright in a White Pages telephone directory. Certainly our continental neighbours call for some element of personal intellectual creation before there can be an author's right. And they're now mounting a high Brussels horse which may turn us back into their line of thought. They're seeking to insist that mundane, non-selective databases such as simple telephone and street directories, be kept out of copyright and given only a lesser neighbouring right. This, give or take the whole question of refurbishing the database, will be for a short term, currently 15 years is proposed, and subject to compulsory licensing when there are certain types of monopoly sourcing. The database solution, should it work out to perform in any way like its proponents imagine, will then be used as a springboard for a substantial test of originality throughout copyright. But in reality, and this is what needs emphasizing, even such a test is likely to call for no very significant measure of creativity. Copyright laws, then, protect creators great and small, and the nature and scope of the protection ought to bear some reasonable relation to the rationales which underlie the laws. Let me take two dubious issues which immediately arise. What can possibly justify giving very minor productions, some pop songs and their lyrics perhaps, copyright for an author's life plus 50 years or plus 70 years, as the European Union is now insisting it become by virtue of a policy of indiscriminate kindness towards copyright industries? Up to now, I would suggest that it's this. There's been an assumption, mostly untested and rarely even discussed, that there's a sufficient correlation between the aesthetic value of a work and its potential for sustained economic exploitation. In our century, it's Colette, but not Cartland or Cookson, Leha, but dare I say it, not Lloyd Webber, which live on for more than a passing edition or set of releases. It must be one of the deepest questions of the coming digitization whether this rough equation, more assumed than investigated, will survive into a world of almost infinite retrieval. What equally can justify giving an employer the whole copyright of a work made during and for the employment, with no further entitlement for the author than salary? We and other leading systems of patent law, in various ways, consider that the employment contract is an insufficient recompense to an employed inventor who produces patentable inventions for the employer's advantage, at least in some extreme cases. Why then is there no system of adjustment for the much more personal and therefore long-lasting production of copyright material, including, as it does these days, the writing of computer programs? Again, there is probably some unvoiced assumption that on the whole, great works are not produced in employment, but by independent creators, at most acting under commission. Where this is not so, as in the production of films, the investment involved is of such a high order that long terms of protection against copying may have their own special justification. There is no sufficient misfit between purpose and effect for the whole conceptual edifice to crumble, but it has to be acknowledged that it's somewhat rickety, at which point one may well despair, as did Mark Twain, who said, "Only one thing is impossible to God, to find any sense in any copyright law on this planet." But if one doesn't share his desperation, one should insist that the law lives up to its pretensions. It gives authors substantial, long-lasting rights because the best of them deserve so much and the lesser fry derive lesser advantages which appear roughly proportionate to their deserts. Is it then enough that the law should set out the exclusive rights of exploitation, reproduction, performance, associated acts, and leave authors and their entrepreneurs to get on with putting down piracy? Or should it also intervene in author-exploiter relationships so as to bolster the weaker, less commercially adept party? The cry for authors' rights is for just such an interventionist policy, and a new note of fervour is entering as it is learned that with digitalization, single corporations are acquiring electronic rights in great swathes of copyright material, whether it be on a subject, such as all English language cookbooks, or from a place, such as all the pictures in the Louvre. At this juncture, continental tradition leads us down forked paths where the signposts distinguish moral rights and economic rights. Let me follow them seriatim, recalling nonetheless Jean Racine's connection between them. Long ago he said, "Sans argent, l'honneur n'est qu'une maladie." Le droit moral de l'auteur, Urheberpersönlichkeitsrecht. The concept translates into English rather better from German than from French, though everybody uses moral rights these days. What is at issue are rights which protect the expression of the author's personality through his or her work. The core idea arose in France through the pragmatic responses of judges, and in Germany through the high theorizing of Otto von Guericke and Joseph Kohler. And so it developed rather differently. The French stressed the separation of moral and economic rights, and therefore allowed the moral rights to attach perpetually and inalienably to the author and his inheritors. The Germans stretched the interdependence, two branches of a single elm, as the mighty Ulmer pictured it, so that the personal and economic rights must expire together. In their modern statutes, both countries have placed the moral rights in high position, equal at least to the economic rights. The moral rights essential, the economic, in a sense, only consequential. Many countries in the civilian tradition have been drawn into some measure of imitation. Since 1948, the Berne Convention, Article 6 bis, has enshrined the two most central of these rights, the right to be named as author and the right to object to disreputable distortion of a work. The essential stimulus for this legal development has undoubtedly been admiration of the great creative talents of the past, if not always of the present. The high claims of romantics, such as Coleridge and Wordsworth, for the numinous perspicacity of artistic creators, has sustained the spread of copyright laws in general and the ideas of moral right in particular. But what matters is not so much the claims of creative genius as the deep social cultural response to their actual work. There are those who choose to treat the romantic vision as in some way imposed on dim perceivers, but there's a larger faith, and I'm happy to belong to it, which believes that its own judgment in appreciating the arts and honouring artists is not unduly conditioned by the manipulators of bourgeois values. Accordingly, I approach the concept of moral rights with an inherent sympathy. Like most common lawyers, I'm of course suspicious of undue extensions of non-contractual protection, and have been somewhat startled by the potential range of these notions. Take, for instance, the case of France, where moral rights are said to be not only inalienable, which turns out to be grand rhetoric for exercisable only personally, but also unwaivable, which is undoubtedly more problematic, but appears to mean not waivable beforehand or unduly widely. The various instances in French law derive from a general principle and so don't form a closed list. To give a quick impression, no matter how committed contractually, an author, and in particular a visual artist, is not bound to hand over a work before he or she decides that it is finished. As early as 1900, James McNeill Whistler was entitled to keep back a commissioned portrait even after he'd exhibited it, though he did remain liable to meet any resultant damages. Under French law, an author also has the right to insist that work which he's destroyed should not be patched together by others, and if he's prepared to compensate, he may demand its withdrawal from the market. Pity, on the other hand, those who've commissioned work and have allowed execution to commence. Renault commissioned Jean-Philippe Dubuffet to design a sculpture which would occupy 1,800 square meters of its forecourt. Once the company undertook to construct Salon d'Été, it found itself under a mandatory order to complete the project, despite a liquidated damages clause in the agreement. Objectionable departures from a text are likely to be held contrary to its integrity. Famously, Samuel Beckett was able to stop female tramps from waiting for Godot. And recently, equally famously, TNT could not show in France a newly colorized version of John Huston's black and white film, Asphalt Jungle, against the objection of the young Hustons, despite the fact that no such objection could be taken under the American law transferring rights to TNT. Most extraordinarily to me, the English publisher of Albert Camus was liable in damages for also publishing a critical biography of the author, which cast doubt not just on his literary skill, but on his integrity and ability to sustain personal relationships. And so much for the claim often made that moral rights go to protection of the work and not the author. Moral right thinking in this case yoked the publisher in a subjugate fiduciary posture. If one gets beyond the high-flown rhetoric into details of practice in France and similar countries, two things become clear. First, where authors are offered the legal opportunity to object to certain ways of exploiting their works, situations arise regularly in which they assert claims. The entitlement to be named as an author, securing a place in film credits, for example, can boost one's whole career. Where the matter is a continual source of tension, as with films, in all likelihood it will be resolved by collective bargaining to a level of detail which could scarcely be achieved by general principles, statutory or judge-made. Thus, not only in France, but equally in the UK and the US, there exist agreements between screenwriters' unions and the major production companies on the size and placement of accreditation, accompanied by special procedures for dispute settlement. Secondly, the rights can be defined in general law only in basic terms. The fit to particular cases must be left to the sense of courts, both in determining the scope of rights and in settling appropriate remedies. In many French cases, the mighty assertion of authorial dignity is assuaged by a quite minor award of damages. When a court goes to the extreme of requiring a commissioner to have a sculpture or a television series completed, the result is greeted with considerable scepticism from the highest professorial authority of the day. Common law countries have shown some reluctance to admit moral rights in these extended forms into the pantheon of copyright. They've pointed to existing rules, mostly judge-made, as providing a sufficient basis for protecting an author's personality, defamation against the truly derogatory adaptation of a work, express or implied contractual terms against undue alteration, passing off against false attribution, and ultimately a number of statutory provisions in different jurisdictions which could be used to prevent misrepresentation in a wide sense. These have included, for instance, the extensive insertion of advertisements into Monty Python's Flying Circus when it was shown on US television. When, after its extraordinary absence from the Berne Union for more than a century, the United States finally became a member in 1989, it was allowed to do so without enacting federal provisions on moral rights, though it's since introduced some in the field of visual arts. The year before, 1988, United Kingdom was finally moved to include four specific moral rights in the new Copyright Act. But as is well known, they're severely limited in a variety of ways, by a range of exceptions, by a general power to take an advance waiver, by the requirement, in the case of the important right to be named, that it's first positively asserted. Much the same caution has been manifested in Canada and Australia. And in my view, it's an appropriate caution, despite all the scorn from so-called authors' rights countries. For they equally have needed time and experience before embodying such protection in their statutes. Britain still has no knowledge of how its new provisions will fare in the courts. And this is necessary before a second round of change is hazarded. But in a decade or so, it will be right to ask whether some of the more restrictive aspects of the new statutory provisions here need to be retained. Assertion of the attribution right, for instance, and the all-embracing exceptions for the press. As to the question of waiver, the central issue is bound to be affected by the way in which copyright protection as a whole responds to the advent of digital technology, and to this I shall return anon. Before I do so, let me introduce issues which have to do with the author's economic interests. International copyright circles are now strongly debating the basic content of copyright contracts. It's a debate at various levels, but the root issue must be whether, and if so, how far, these contracts, and in particular those outside the employment relationship, should be placed within a regulatory framework. Since gardening is the greatest art form outside the range of copyright, let it provide a metaphor. If there's to be a law of copyright contracts, how far will it consist of mere layout planning? How far of infilling on a presumptive basis? And how far of bedrocking? So far as layout planning goes, there's a case for prescribing the basic content, which must be put in writing in a copyright commission. Say, in the case of publishing, the license or assignment of copyright which has been given by the author, for how long, for what territories, the nature and length of proposed work, delivery date, publishing schedule, royalties, lump sum or lump sums, for the various elements within the copyright granted. The aim of such a layout is not to prescribe or presume any particular terms, but to ensure, in the author's interest, that the essentials have been covered in a form adequately recorded. British publishers have been shocked by a recent Court of Appeal decision holding that the Oxford University Press had, in the course of discussions by an editor with a rather persistent philosopher, undertaken to publish his book and were liable in damages for not doing so. Suddenly, publishers would like a written form law, which would mean that there would be no contract until writing. But publishers surely should be encouraged to look after themselves. Under a layout law, the contract ought still to be provable on oral evidence, but not enforceable against the author. Infilling laws, my second category, create presumptive rules operating in the absence of express terms which displace them. Our copyright acts, for instance, have provisions denominating ownership of copyright at the moment when the work is created. Under the 1988 Act, ownership presumptively goes to the author unless the work is produced within employment or under a prior agreement to assign. But this is effectively a rule which operates in the absence of clear agreement to the contrary. Clear, though not necessarily express, as Lord Evershed once made plain when indicating that the copyright in lectures delivered by Professor Maitland belonged to him and not to the University of Cambridge. The moral rights, which we've given authors to be named and to object to derogatory treatment, because of the provisions allowing waiver, fall essentially within this category. Germany has long had a law relating to the publication of literature, which, in typically thorough style, lays down a series of presumptive terms reasonably favourable to the author. In consequence, all but dozy or very amateur publishers in Germany use written, more or less standard form agreements. Dr. Adolf Dietz, the German author's finest friend, describes these overriding terms as all too often unfair. Bedrocking, the third category, implants boundary stones which cannot be shifted by contractual manipulation. Countries which severely restrict the waiver of moral rights are doing just this. Of the same quality are our own rules relating to unenforceable restraints of trade, undue influence, and other forms of unconscionable bargaining. You'll scarcely need reminding that rising pop composers and or performers have been the figures who, more than anyone else, have been able to convince our courts of the need to terminate long-term contracts and sometimes to deprive the other party of copyrights or to restore them to their authors. Thus have Macaulay, Fleetwood Mac, Gilbert O'Sullivan, Elton John succeeded, in some degree at least, in escaping obligations suited only to their apprentice years. Whether George Michael would join the honourable company is the great question of the hour. Today, so much contracting over copyright is multinational that bedrocking as a public policy constraint is all too liable to raise conflicts of law. Since copyright arises country by country and is enforceable in each territory in accordance with its local law, a bedrocked rule is likely to apply in that territory whatever the law governing the contract may or may not provide on the matter. Indeed, if the moral impetus is strong enough, a country may seek to impose bedrock conditions extraterritorially to the extent that it can reach a person who fails to abide by them. In the Albert Camus case, which I've already mentioned, the French court had no difficulty in imposing the author's right of integrity on the firm of Hamish Hamilton, the English sub-licensees of his work, for publishing outspoken criticism of Camus in England. On the economic side, Dr. Dietz has recently argued that the German right of an artist to a 5% share in the commercial sale of an original work, such as a picture or a sculpture, should be recoverable in Germany, at least by a German artist against a German vendor, even where the sale took place in a country which has no such right. In the case in point, involved the sale of paintings by the cult figure Joseph Beuys at Christie's in London. This is, of course, all dangerous new ground. The European Commission has seen to it that there are bits of bedrocking in recent directives by which, interstitially, the copyright laws of member states are being standardised. Its directive requiring computer programs to be treated as literary works with a full copyright term, however excessive that may seem, requires that lawful users of program copies be permitted to make backup copies and in some circumstances to engage in decompilation and testing. Its directive requiring a rental right as part of the copyright given to authors and to neighbouring right holders insists that authors and performers must have a right to equitable remuneration out of remedies from exploitation of this new right. Indeed, the Commission is now concerned to secure the international effectiveness of these entrenchments. We're likely soon to see campaigns for rights principally affecting the relations between authors and those who exploit their work, probably performers as well, which will insist on more or less complete bedrocking of certain protections. The most obvious can be listed in short order. There will be pressure to render the established moral rights, and perhaps some new ones, not just inalienable but unwaivable, at least until some moment when the author must be expected to choose one way or the other. In the sphere of economic rights, there will also be concerns over unexpected, if not wholly unanticipated, outcomes from arrangements to exploit. On the one hand, there's the case of non-exploitation. Should an author not have an unwaivable power to withdraw his work after a set period from an assignee or exclusive licensee who has entirely shelved it? And if this is so, is there a case for allowing withdrawal in face of a failure to use best endeavours to exploit? On the other hand, and probably of greater practical impact, there are various cases of unanticipated exploitation. Should an author have a fair share guaranteed in returns which follow from a sudden wild success? We give inventors some such guarantee in our patent law. We interfere in the operation of authors' contracts where success leaves them bound to continuing arrangements suited to the struggling tyro. The Germans have a bestseller clause in their copyright law. More importantly, they read copyright contracts subject to a Zweckübertragungsgrundsatz in their Copyright Act, by which grants of use rights are treated as being solely for the purpose or purposes envisaged by the contract. Of this I shall have more to say in connection with the daunting effects of digitization. The only justification for copyright extending beyond a term necessary to attract the investment needed for its creation and first exploitation is the moral assertion that authors personally deserve a property right in the results of their intellectual labour, which may at least be enjoyed by a generation or two of their successors. Why doesn't the law then guarantee that the author and his or her estate continues to share in the profits of a long-lasting work? In the Imperial Copyright Act of 1911, but not in the subsequent Act of 1956, we gave the author's estate a reversionary right during the last years of the copyright. The Americans still have a right, in some circumstances, for the author to terminate assignments and licenses some 35 years into the copyright period. Adopting a different tack, French law entitles an author to a proportionate share in earnings from exploitation of work. This at least seems to guarantee continuous sharing as opposed to being paid off with a lump sum. But the law lays down no particular proportion, and anyway, it's so pitted with exceptions as to resemble a delphinium after slug attack. However, with a stronger molluscicide, an author's plant might flourish. It would be far better supported if the right were to be a right to equitable remuneration, such as the rental directive insists upon in one isolated instance that I've mentioned. In the context of relations between author and exploiter, the notion would act as a guarantee, secured if necessary by resort to outside arbitration, that the author should have continuous and reasonable return from successful work. If the copyright industries wish to sustain rights based on the claims of authors, and it should be apparent by now that authors bring in their train a highly beneficial range of protection, then it behoves them to give serious thought to the extent to which there should be legal guarantees of the interests of authors themselves in contractual arrangements for exploitation. In particular, where technical advance brings new opportunities for exploitation, the relationship, not necessarily governed by whatever contractual terms may have been agreed without knowledge of the new technique. If they simply fight against this trend, they will face the hostility of the courts, as already exhibited in the restraint of trade and undue influence cases, and they'll not be able to show why they should be the fortuitous beneficiaries of essentially unfair terms for the exploitation of rights which are intended on their face for creators. So, to draw towards an end, let me return to the great digitization question. I'm not today investigating the awe-inspiring difficulties which face those who would prevent quantities of copyright material from being transferred free around electronic networks. If any practical notion of property is to survive in this presumptively brave new world, the technical means of controlling it have to be devised and then, where necessary, backed by legal enforcement. Whoever first makes material available within a digital net is relatively easy to identify and control. The greater problems are with subsequent users who may themselves be adapters of it. So much as it is at stake that partial systems are already being marketed and total controls are under experiment. Don't forget, however, the length of time it has taken for copyright administration to come to terms with funny old technologies like reprography and home taping. My concern today is with the place of the author of material which is drawn into or is generated by this wondrous new potentiality. Suppose for a moment some future celebration of an MLR editor, let's say on retirement rather than any funerary occasion. Perhaps it'll take place in this room. Gone will be the books, the windows will be blacked. From a digitized projection of Sir William Nicholson's dual portrait, Sidney and Beatrice Webb might be seen to step down, take their places at the Blüthner and the Bösendorfer, and play the arrival of the Queen of Sheba, as have great statisticians and sociologists in days of yore in this room. They will rise and shake the editor's hand, encased as it will be in its sensing glove. Their virtual voices might sing a founding parent's pain to the editor's achievement in converting the review from paper into indestructible binary stream retrievable on screen or out of printer. Shot through this public performance and the prior recording needed to bring it about will be copyright and neighbouring right material, which is in principle will require to be licensed. Let us content ourselves just with Sir William Nicholson's rights in the portrait. Since he died British in 1949, his successors or assigns will be enjoying copyright here, thanks to the EC's unguarded generosity, until the end of 2019. Assuming that the digitized version of the portrait was produced with their consent, can they control those who obtain it from the digital bank and then extract and manipulate its figures? Think what unsavory might be done with the dog. To the extent that contractual conditions are in place, they or their assigns will have rights. Should they have a moral right against objectionable manipulation? And if so, how far should permissible manipulation be measured against objective criteria of, say, derogatory treatment, as distinct from subjective distaste on the part of the estate? You can see how legal questions could proliferate. Whose consent, if there are co-inheritors? Likewise, if the work has been one of joint authorship? Copyright lawyers are amongst those now in a ferment about the sudden bursting of the new technology and the need to channel it so that the very idea of proprietary rights can survive the flood. The answer must depend largely on building in means of ready identification, of securing quick permission, including much given on a standard basis, of providing confidential communication by methods of encryption. It's plain that those who allow their material to be held in digitized form must expect that rights will be exercised thereafter through a collecting society. We may soon be nearer the end of the road for individual licensing than we are even at present. In truth, just as now, an occasional copying or converting of material will in all likelihood occur without restraint or compensation. It will only be if there's been some mass interest in the event, and in particular in replaying it, that real copyright interests will come into play. My example of the Nicholson portrait is in all likelihood rather far-fetched, but it's as good an illustration as any other of the question: in this new world, should proprietary interests continue to stem from the creative steps of authors, or should they be attenuated to some neighbouring right protecting investors generally against corner-cutting imitation? This issue folds in together with the separate factor making much of the separate factor considered earlier. Will not digitization have the effect of making much that is of very low aesthetic worth into material of continuing economic value? If so, again, should one not abandon any longevous and protective author's right? That's a question which ought to be kept in the forefront of developments over the next decade. If authors survive, and in practice they'll prove hard to kill, then it's crucial, among all the difficulties, that their interest is not attenuated simply because of the grave difficulties of bringing copyists to book. As I've said, digitization will force the march already underway towards collective administration of rights. To the extent that the technology permits the tracking of digital material, it is no comparable problem to subdivide returns in accordance with legal rights and agreed proportions. The best hope, so far as earnings are concerned, is indeed that interests will be represented through collectivities of authors, composers, and artists. This should reduce pressure for rules concerning copyright contracts which are bedrocked into general law. There will remain a case, however, for general laws about the impact of unanticipated technical change and to protect those individuals who continue to fall outside the range of collective bargains. What is needed above all in an ideal future is a series of collective solutions which offer authors a slate of opportunities. Once they've agreed to digital storage of their work, authors should be able to choose. On the one hand, they may license it for unfettered use. On the other, for use only in unaltered form. Or, in between, for consideration on a case-by-case basis. But those who want this last, finely balanced possibility, allowing them to maximize returns from use while at the same time excluding demeaning or otherwise unacceptable excesses, must understand that in a rapid delivery world, this luxury has its not inconsiderable price, and that therefore they should meet the cost of choice. As the charivari of copyright rattles erratically forward, this may prove one practical way of preserving the individuality of the author. It may also preserve a sense of proportion, a measure of scepticism against the most overbearing demands of the artistic personality. In the end, one does need to remember the Shropshire lad's blithe dictum, "Malt does more than Milton can to justify the ways of God to man." And that, Chairman, I think, indicates that it's time for a drink.
January issue of Modern Law Review, unless you start changing it and withhold it from us. can we invite you all downstairs to the floor below to have a drink with us? You should be ready now. Make your way down slowly. Thank you.